content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia with the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from The Teen Magazine and Teen Vogue. The first article is from The Teen Magazine, and it's titled, What It Means to Be Mental Health Literate Today. Phrases such as, I'm so depressed, and I had a panic attack at the thought of it, are those often thrown around in schools as small talk. Teens around the world are plagued by these words in the midst of struggling with what is expected of them academically and socially. After a global pandemic and increasing suicide rates of teenagers around the globe, it is significantly important to acknowledge that while we all have different, important experiences, we need to remain respectful of others too. This article will break down some ways we can improve our grasp of mental health literacy and how we can build on this to make the environments we inhabit safe for everybody. A quick disclaimer. I am not a professional, nor do I have any experience in psychology. I am merely interested in learning more about the field. This article is not intended to be and should not be used as a diagnosis. If you are struggling, please seek help from a licensed professional or make an appointment with your general practitioner to begin with. All of the information in this article is derived from the web sources on each disorder and personal experience with people who are diagnosed. For more information, I have included a link to a source at the end of this each section for your perusal. Why should I be careful? There is an impactful stigma towards mental health illnesses, particularly in teens and young adults, but we often ignore the other side of the equation. Creating normality of mental health battles, including procrastination, poor relationships with food, obsessive-compulsive tendencies, or anxiety are often disrespectful to those who are clinically diagnosed, particularly if they already feel excluded from and misunderstood by society. It may make them think they don't need to seek help since it's so common, or encourage them to believe that their feelings aren't valid as they watch others joke about their illness on a daily basis. The stigmas around mental illnesses and psychological disorders prohibit true understanding of these often foreign experiences to the individual and are rooted in the deep history of ignorance toward people who seem different. Therefore, it's important to start reading about the real, raw struggles of others to better understand ourselves and the surrounding community, and to be aware that some statements are not relevant or acceptable like they were in the past. Some examples. Number one, I'm so depressed. Depression is debilitating sadness, a lack of motivation, and long-standing beliefs of worthlessness. Depression, alongside anxiety, is something most people will experience at some stage in their life, whether it be for a short period, like 2 weeks, or something more chronic, like 6 months or more. Clinical depression is recognized as persistently depressed moods or lack of interest and motivation that greatly impairs someone's quality of life. Throwing around the word depressed with connotations of a major depressive disorder without an official diagnosis can be extremely harmful to somebody suffering in silence or even someone open about their experience. Unfortunately, many young adult novels normalize the experiences of depression and even romanticize their impact on the person's life, leaving out the paralyzing sadness and symptoms that aren't as pretty. Exposure to this representation changes the perspective of the severity of the disorder for a larger audience, particularly for young people, which influences the way many of us approach it in conversation. So, if you had OCD, You would be compelled to fix the order of your pins or fix the disrupted patterns out of fear of something bad happening. Even saying you are obsessive-compulsive may be incorrect if your rituals aren't connected to anxiety or a specific worry. In the end, if you are undiagnosed, there's really no reason to say you're OCD about something. Number 3. Everyone is a little bipolar sometimes. Mood swings are completely natural, and humans are born to respond to stimuli in their environment that affect their emotions and feelings. However, these mood changes are exaggerated to the extreme for some with bipolar. From states of mania involving high levels of risky behavior to paralyzing depression that sometimes leaves them bedridden. Not everyone is a little bipolar, because if they were, bipolar disorder would be a consistent diagnosis among humans when it currently only affects approximately 2.8% of people in the United States. It's completely acceptable to help someone with the ups and downs of their life because regardless of if you have a clinical disorder or not, your emotions are real, they're important, and valid. In saying this, the common message is that you should be cautious when using the name of disorders for typical experiences when you have not been diagnosed, and the same message goes for bipolar disorder. Some examples of bipolar disorder symptoms, some examples of the mania and hypomania, inflated self-esteem or grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, pressured speech, racing thoughts or flight of ideas, distractibility, increased activity, excess pleasurable or risky activity. The difference between mania and hypomania is mania involves symptoms caused marked impairment, and they're present for greater than 7 days. Hypomania, these symptoms do not cause marked impairment, and they're present for between 4 and 7 days. Examples of the depression part of bipolar disorder include depressed mood, diminished interest or pleasure, weight loss or gain, insomnia or hyperinsomnia, psychomotor agitation or retardation, loss of energy, feeling worthless or guilty, recurring thoughts of death, and indecisiveness. This is usually present for greater than 7 days. Number 4. I get distracted so easily. It's like I have ADHD. People with ADHD or other neurodevelopmental disorders often struggle to become diagnosed because of how common their symptoms can be within the general population. People get distracted, people fixate on their interests, people interrupt others, and people procrastinate. Far too often, those with ADHD struggle for many years before reaching out for a diagnosis, and it's highly probable that a percentage of them remain undiagnosed. Just like with many other disorders discussed in this article, it's when these behaviors or struggles become so frequent and unstoppable on their own that it can be considered a disorder entitled ADHD. Another aspect of ADHD is the related symptom known as rejection-sensitive dysphoria, which means they can often be highly sensitive to rejection, criticism, or dismissal. It is also common in people with autism. As such, be careful with where you use the clinical term in your conversations to avoid harming others. Number 5. I had a panic attack just thinking about it. Those who have gone through a panic attack often describe it as feeling as if you're dying. Also referred to as an anxiety attack, many common somatic symptoms include a racing heartbeat, dizziness, trembling, and breathing difficulties. This is different from the cold shivers you may get when you have a quick worry about something, or the anxiousness you may feel in your body when thinking about an exam or a first date. Panic attacks can be random or induced by intense levels of anxiety, which is not something to casually use in conversation. As demonstrated above, there are many effects of the anxiety experience on the physical body, as well as the person's psyche. If you ever feel like you're undergoing an anxiety attack, something recommended is to look around and name things that you observe. This helps ground you back into the moment instead of fixating on the way you feel or what you think is happening to you. There are numerous other examples that extremely downplay the experience and struggles of someone with a mental health illness, and I recommend reading through articles discussing specific disorders that you may not know much about. I encourage you to be more cautious about how you phrase things, especially around people you aren't familiar with. It's a common idea, but you can never truly know what's going on in someone else's life. But I believe you can always learn more and be respectful of those differences. This article was written by Alana Wessling. Alana Wessling is an Australian high school student planning to enroll in a journalism and creative writing course after school. She is highly interested in digital technologies, history, and fictional writing. She is currently co-writing an action romance novel series focused on the themes of confidence and overcoming hardships and mental illness. Alana thoroughly enjoys spending her time with friends and family, writing tips and tricks for other authors, and reading anything and everything. The next article is from Teen Vogue. It's titled, Simone Biles, Ali Raisman, Michaela Maroney, and Maggie Nichols speak out against FBI's failure to investigate sexual abuse. This article is by Jessica Taylor Price and was published September 15th of 2021. When elite gymnast Maggie Nichols and her coach told USA Gymnastics in 2015 that Larry Nassar had abused her, the FBI was alerted soon after. Nassar's decades-long serial abuse of hundreds of women and girls should have ended there. It didn't. Instead, Nassar continued to work as a doctor at Michigan State University for over a year, until a lawsuit alleging abuse was filed that led to him being fired in September of 2016 and charged with criminal sexual conduct with a person under 13 in November. Subsequent charges followed. During that time, the FBI knew about the abuse allegations and didn't take adequate action, according to a Justice Department report that was published in July, and at least 40 more women and girls say they were abused. How did the FBI fail to bring Nassar down? On Wednesday morning, Nichols, along with fellow USAG athletes Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Ali Raisman, demanded answers as they testified at an hour-long Senate hearing into the FBI's management of the case. The survivors of Larry Nassar have a right to know why their well-being was placed in jeopardy by these individuals who chose not to do their jobs, Nichols said in her statement. Nichols, who earned gold and bronze medals at the 2015 World Championships, says she was abused at a national team training camp. Also known as Athlete A, she was the first USAG athlete to report Nassar's abuse to the USAG. 6 years after her initial report, she's still wondering how Nassar was allowed to have access to women and girls even after she reported him. In sacrificing my childhood for the chance to compete for the United States, I am haunted by the fact that even after I reported my abuse, so many women and girls had to needlessly suffer at the hands of Larry Nassar, she said. USA Gymnastics, the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, and the FBI have all betrayed me. Nichols' testimony aligns with the Justice Department's findings that the FBI didn't take the case seriously enough. The FBI didn't interview her until more than a year after her complaint, Nichols said, failed to issue search warrants during this time, and lied to OIG investigators about what had occurred. What's more, the report states that the FBI agent in charge of the case applied for a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee, and denying doing so twice to the Office of the Inspector General interviewers, when admitting that taking such a job would be a conflict of interest. Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, apologized to the survivors at the hearing. "I want to be crystal clear," he said. "The actions and inaction of the FBI committees detailed in this report are totally unacceptable." In her own disturbing statement, Olympic gold medalist Michaela Maroney, who says she was abused by Nassar hundreds of times throughout her gymnastic career, beginning when she was 13, said her story was minimized and disregarded by the FBI and then buried. After telling my entire story of abuse to the FBI in the summer of 2015, not only did the FBI not report my abuse, but when they eventually documented my report 17 months later, they made entirely false claims about what I said, she said. They had legal, legitimate evidence of child abuse and did nothing. The trauma of having allegations mishandled adds to the trauma of the abuse itself, Olympic gold medalist Allie Raisman said in her statement. Over the past few years, it has become painfully clear how a survivor's healing is affected by the handling of their abuse, she said. According to Raisman, it took the FBI 14 months to contact her, and when they did, I remember sitting there with the FBI agent and him trying to convince me that it wasn't that bad, she said. Raisman's struggles continue to this day. Being here today is taking everything I have, she said. My main concern is I hope I have the energy even to just walk out of here. The emotional toll of the hearing was clear during Simone Biles' testimony as well. I don't want another young gymnast, Olympic athlete, or any individual to experience the horror that I and hundreds of others have endured before, during, and continuing to this day in the wake of Larry Nassar's abuse, Biles said as she broke down. She wondered aloud why she wasn't made aware of the investigation until after the Rio Games, and said she lives with a daily reminder of the abuse. The senators at the hearing responded, including Senator Richard Blumenthal, who said the FBI's failure to act had real human consequences, and that will be forever a stain on the FBI's reputation. It should not be a survivor's burden to continually seek justice and demand an end to their nightmares, said California Senator Dianne Feinstein. Currently, the Justice Department hasn't brought charges against either of the two agents who were most closely involved in the case, NPR reports. During the hearing, Ray said that Special Agent Michael Langman was fired in recent weeks. His supervisor, Jay Abbott, had previously resigned. But Biles made it clear that the fight wasn't over. Nassar's where he belongs, but those who enabled him deserve to be held accountable, Biles said. Maroney called for criminal prosecution of the agents for what she called an obvious crime. My abuse was enough, and we deserve justice, she said. The next article is titled, End of Eviction Moratorium Leaves Students at Risk of Homelessness. This article is a part of Teen Vogue's Miseducation series, which is a column that chronicles what it is like to be a student in the modern United States. This article is written by Mary Retta and was published September 17th, 2021. It's a rough cycle. To stay safe from COVID, we were told to avoid unnecessary excursions, limiting our exposure to strangers. But as unemployment rates skyrocketed throughout the pandemic, many people struggled to pay rent, and the unhoused population grew. Recently, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, issued a new temporary federal eviction moratorium after the previous one had expired, albeit with more caveats. The moratorium wasn't meant to, as the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness states, respond to recent unexpected developments in the trajectory of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the rise of the Delta variant. Soon after, however, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration's new ban. According to one estimate, the court's decision could cause 3.5 million families to lose their homes, with families of color and low-income people most at risk. This measure could also have devastating impacts for students. I was slightly comforted by the fact that I couldn't be evicted until October, when the extension was set to expire, but now I don't have that same guarantee, says Sai Ali, a student at American Public University, tells Teen Vogue. I'm at risk of being homeless. I can't fully focus on classes because I'm worried that I won't have a place to complete my assignments or have access to Wi-Fi at some point. Nikki Del Casale, a campaign co-coordinator for the Cancel Rent Coalition, is concerned that the rise in evictions will affect college students and K-12 students too. I'm worried that the end of the eviction ban will put many students in precarious positions, including the potential to lose housing, drop out of school, and become unhoused, Del Casale tells Teen Vogue via email. I am terrified that this will most affect many young people who may already be at a disadvantage, such as LGBTQIA youth, youth escaping from some type of trauma, and youth whose outlet or safe space is school. If you lose housing, you can lose education. Unhoused students across the United States were already in crisis before the pandemic began. According to 2020 research from the National Education Association that came out just before the pandemic, there were approximately 1.5 million students nationwide who at some point over the previous 3 years experienced a lack of a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, including those sharing accommodations, staying at hotels, or sleeping in any public space. From just the 2016 to 2017 school year to the 2017 to 2018 school year, the number of unhoused students in the U.S. jumped by 15%, and that figure is still on the rise, according to the report. Research also shows that students experiencing homelessness are more likely to face academic difficulties and have higher rates of emotional, behavioral, and immediate and long-term health concerns. But this year, the stakes are even higher. As some students learn remotely or take blended classes during COVID, some homes are still doubling in classrooms. Some homes are still doubling as classrooms. An eviction could mean not only losing a home, but losing a reliable Wi-Fi and a space to learn. In these pandemic times, having a laptop or virtual device is basically a necessity, and programs in cities do not always have the budget to supply children with these devices, says Del Casale. If families are evicted, they may also not have access to reliable internet, further destabilizing their education. Katrina, a Cornell University student and community organizer in Ithaca, New York, says that the threat of eviction will fall disproportionately on low-income students and students of color who are far more likely to be paying for their own rent. Last winter, she and her roommates were forced to take classes from freezing bedrooms in their Ithaca home when the heat was broken. Katrina says the experience helped her understand how landlord practices and housing precarity come in direct conflict with student tenants' ability to learn, especially when courses are online. The possibility of eviction has made some students rethink their plans for school. When I was a kid, people would always tell me that poor children don't go to college. But now that I'm older, I don't want to go, says Quentin, a high school graduate from Washington, D.C., who prefers not to use his last name. But there's a lot to consider. Student debt is already so high, and now it's looking like things like housing and internet aren't even guarantees. Lately, I've been thinking of staying closer to home and going to community college instead. Quentin had tried to find a part-time job during his senior year of high school to support his family, but to no avail. I've already asked a couple of my friends if we could stay with them if we get evicted, Quentin said. It wouldn't be the first time. Lark Yasmin, a tenants' rights activist in Washington, D.C., says that looming evictions worry her as both an organizer and a mom. Mothers have been hit particularly hard by the pandemic, she tells Teen Vogue. I'm scared to send my kids to school because of the Delta variant, and I'm scared to have them home because we could be evicted. This is a systemic class and race issue. It's so unfair that these evictions will help my landlord and help his children, whereas my child might be homeless. Del Casale sees a link between evictions and other systemic race issues, such as gentrification and the debt crisis, and believes that all of these issues must be tackled to ensure that students and their families have fair housing and safe access to education. Many Black and Brown Washingtonians have been unable to pay rent and are facing eviction, huge amounts of debt, or both when the moratorium is lifted, says Del Casale. When families have more debt, they may not be able to provide food for their children, nor financial assistance for education. These issues are linked, and we have to tackle all of them to ensure that all students have fair access to education and a safe home. And to wrap up the show, I'm going to read from one of my favorite articles from Teen Vogue. I'll read some excerpts from it. It's titled "The Best Advice from Therapists from 50 Different People." And I'll just read some of those therapist advice that were shared. Evelyn said her therapist advised her to change your perspective and everything else will fall into place. Evelyn's take: I would make situations out of nothing, speak impulsively, and had moments when I would be screaming to get my point across. A lot of it stemmed from not feeling that I was up to my family standards. My therapist made me realize that it's my mindset that has to change, and my overall outlook on my natural abilities to succeed. Dominic's therapist said, trust yourself. Dominic's thoughts: it stopped me in my tracks. I grew up with the message that I don't know what's best for me, or that I'm incapable of knowing, and it took going to therapy and getting that reminder to guide me back on track. Phillips' thoughts, a therapist said, if a plane goes down, you have to put your mask on before you help someone else. Phillips' thoughts, during my junior year, I was taking a lot of responsibilities for myself and my family. Oftentimes, my family obligations went above my own. I had to focus on my needs and take care of myself. All right, we've now run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.